All right. So it wouldn't be much of a strength and conditioning for physical therapist podcasts if we didn't talk about kind of ways and methods to optimize, so to speak, strength and conditioning in patients or in athletes or whatever we want to call them. Here we call them athletes. And so I wanted to go over a paper that I did a post on that was put out by Dr. Pack and Dr. Wolf to what I would call Instagram influencer researchers that put out some really good papers and articles and easy reads that answer some really kind of good questions when it comes to strength and conditioning and what it is that we know or don't know in the strength and conditioning world. So this paper that they put out called Optimizing Resistance Training Technique to Maximize Muscular, sorry. Optimizing Resistance Training Technique to Maximize Muscle Hypertrophy, a Narrative Review. Dr. Pack, I'm not even going to try and pronounce his full name, is the lead author, and then Dr. Wolf being the secondary author. And I thought that this one did a good job addressing what it is that we do know about muscle hypertrophy or increasing muscle size and what we don't really know and some of the kind of nebulous questions that get asked in the strength and conditioning world that, again, we don't really have a great idea of how to answer or what the answer might be. But I do feel like they did a pretty good job here of kind of addressing all of those things. So to really open the paper up, they talk about the necessity for manipulation of certain resistance training variables, such as training volume, training intensity, or the effort put into training, as well as things like range of motion. And we have previously talked about the four training variables, volume, frequency, intensity, and movement variation. Movement variation covering the range of motion here. But they do point out that, quote, there's no universally agreed upon definition in the scientific literature as to what constitutes proper technique and its constituent components. And so the first part of the paper, which we're going to spend some time on here talking about, is really spent just kind of making claims with evidence to back it up, making recommendations would be a better way to put it on what it is that we need to do to kind of make sure that we're hitting certain marks or certain checkpoints when it comes to muscle hypertrophy. So they did go ahead and define what kind of exercise technique is, and I'm just going to read it here. Resistance training exercise technique pertains to the controlled execution of bodily movements to ensure an exercise effectively targets specific muscle groups while minimizing the risk of injury. This involves the orchestration of body positioning and alignment, range of motion, and repetition tempo. That is a mouthful. So let's go ahead and get started with tempo here. Now, the overall recommendation that they come out with, based on, again, if you want this paper and you haven't read it yet, go ahead and just send me a message and I'll send it to you. But the overall recommendation is that it does indeed appear that significant increases in hypertrophy can occur with repetitions between durations of 2 and 8 seconds. Now, they do point out and they do highlight a bunch of papers that tried different eccentric and concentric as well as isometric times. Eccentric being a slow lengthening or a lengthening contraction, concentric being a shortening contraction, isometric being a non-moving contraction. And they talk about all the different outcomes that have happened with different durations of both eccentric and concentric mixtures. And so the overall recommendation is that it doesn't really so much matter what the specifics of the eccentric and concentric are. Like, you don't need a 1 second concentric and then a 6 second eccentric or vice versa, just as long as the entire repetition is falling between 2 and 8 seconds. But they do say that it would be a good idea to make sure that the eccentric portion is sufficiently controlled so that the muscle is doing the activity. It says that although it is advisable that eccentric actions be performed in a sufficiently controlled manner to ensure that the muscle controls the descent of the weight rather than relying solely on gravitational forces. So, if we take one of the easier ones, let's say a bench press, you want to make sure that you're actually using contraction to lower that barbell down to your chest and not just letting it slam into your chest at the speed of gravity. I don't think many people do that. They might do that with bicep curls, or with maybe an overhead press or a push press or something like that. But that is few and far between, in my opinion and my experience when it comes to watching people train. And so just to repeat that tempo recommendation before we move into range of motion, the tempo recommendation is that you should spend 4 significant increases in hypertrophy between 2 and 8 seconds throughout the entirety of the rep, both concentrically and eccentrically. So that's our first recommendation there. Number 2, we're going to go over range of motion, and the range of motion talk that they have in here goes over both full range of motion and then what's called lengthened partials. Now, I feel like full range of motion is pretty self-explanatory, but a lengthened partial might need a little bit more pulling at. So if you can think of, I think a good representation would be the bottom of a squat. If we're thinking about the hip extensors, the glutes, really the glutes at the bottom of the squat, I guess we could talk about the quads, but let's just focus on the glutes here. At the bottom of a squat, they're in a lengthened position. Now, if you were to do something like a 1 1/4 squat where you go all the way down into the hole of a squat and then come up just a quarter of the way out of the hole or 25% out of the hole and then drop back down into the squat, that would be a lengthened partial because you are doing a partial range of motion in a lengthened state for that hip extensor because that femur is going to be very approximated to the rib cage, and thus the hip extensors are going to be very much so lengthened. And doing partial range of motion reps in that lengthened position seems to have a good effect on hypertrophy. Now, they also point out that most of systematic reviews and meta-analyses find that lengthened or full range of motion training is a great idea, but they also point out that the partial range of motion performed at longer muscle lengths was potentially superior to a full range of motion for hypertrophy. I feel like that is easy to work into, and I personally have been, since some of these papers have been coming out, using part lengthened partials with some of my own personal athletes, and they seem to do okay with them. Nobody's exploded yet in a good or bad way. So we'll see kind of how that pans out. But the second recommendation overall here is that range of motion should be as full as you can get it. And if you can, or if they can tolerate some lengthened partials, that might be a good idea as well. Now, that's not to say that there is no room for shorter range of motions. I know that a lot of folks like to quote doing quarter or half squats at a heavier weight than you might be able to do a full range of motion squat, being good for things like sprinters or jumping. Personally, I can't speak to the correctness of that as I haven't read that recently. But I think that we can rest assured that a full range of motion exercise or full range of motion rep or set is probably going to be good for muscle hypertrophy here. All right, so let's go ahead and get into the third arm of the paper. We have a talk on technique. So the technique one is always tough, right? And I've been a pretty outspoken critic of a correct or incorrect technique simply because there's just so many ways to move, and there's so many ways to organize oneself around equipment. I've said in the past that equipment is kind of dictating what the form looks like, because as we add or subtract equipment, there's going to be more or less things that we need to move around with or interact with. And as a movement optimist, or somebody who practices movement optimism, meaning that I don't really think that there's a right or wrong way to move, this was definitely an interesting read to see what sort of angles that they were getting at and what sort of things they were pointing out and other papers were pointing out. So they did point out that there have been papers that have looked at different foot positions for things like calf muscular hypertrophy, like the soleus and the gastrocnemius, and that different positions of the foot found that there was different activations of the musculature or greater hypertrophy of the musculature, and those two are not interchangeable. And they also said that there were other studies that explored the effect of different grip widths on muscle activations. And the reason that I say that the muscle activation and the muscle hypertrophy are not interchangeable is because they also go out to point that, you know, muscle activation is not necessarily a good predictor of hypertrophy. And so we can't just say, well, this muscle was activated really hard during this foot position, and so that one must be better for hypertrophy. So just something to keep in mind as we go forward, or as you go forward in the muscle activation literature, that muscle activation stuff can get a little bit weird, especially if we're looking at surface EMGs or maximum voluntary isometric contraction or MVIC studies. Just because something has a really hard contraction or is activated more than another position or muscle in a certain movement doesn't mean that that one is going to be directly related to or connected to hypertrophy. Things also get a little bit weird when we talk about technique and form. I think that there is a line to draw in the sand between what is or is not efficient for finishing a movement and what is or is not injurious or inherently risky when it comes to doing a movement. I think that the latter or the risk is much more nuanced than whether or not a movement is efficient. Although I will also say that there are many, many ways to skin a cat when it comes to moving. I mean, you have to walk into literally one gym to see a bunch of different people completing one movement in a bunch of different ways based on their anthropometrics or based on their skill level or based on the weight on the bar and what intensity that weight is for them. So the technique conversation continues to be nuanced despite them kind of talking about it here. So let's go into what things that they kind of talked about. And again, I found these pretty interesting. So number one, they kind of dichotomized or split into two different categories what the form is usually split into. So we have strict and then non-strict. Them saying that strict technique refers to an approach that effectively directs maximum stimulation to the target muscle group or groups by minimizing the direct involvement of other muscle groups, while non-strict technique allows for involvement of ancillary muscle groups. And I feel like that is kind of where folks get a little bit weirded out. You know, we have the argument of using more weight with less strictness, or we have less weight with more strictness, but more of that weight is kind of directed where we're hoping to go to. And I thought that that was a pretty good representation of what the two camps are. But they went to point out that the use of moderate amount of momentum at the beginning of each repetition in a set can allow for the use of heavier loads and thus a better quote-unquote overload of muscles in biomechanically advantageous positions, which conceivably could enhance muscular adaptation. So it sounds like, you know, if we're doing, again, let's say bicep curls for ease of picturing here, if we're doing bicep curls, which is simply a flexion of the elbow bilaterally, potentially, if we're doing something that may be a little bit heavier than we can do without moving the rest of the body, if you are moving the rest of your body, let's say to kind of throw your hips into it or get a little bit of swing going, yes, I mean, less of that weight is being moved by the bicep because there is more of that weight being moved with the rest of the body, but we are using more weight than we would otherwise, and there has to be some sort of translation or transfer effect of using that more of that weight and more of that stimulus to load the biceps. And if we think back to length tension curves or with muscular contraction types, an eccentric contraction is going to be able to produce a whole lot more force than a concentric or an isometric contraction, if I recall correctly. And so despite not being able to potentially curl the weight concentrically up, we could definitely, for the most part, lower that weight with just the use of the biceps, which, you know, is not nothing. And so this is kind of where we start to talk into doing stuff like negatives or eccentric contractions, where the weight might be too heavy for us to do a concentric contraction or a shortening contraction, but it might be, we might be strong enough or able to produce enough force with an eccentric contraction, a lengthening contraction to control that weight, which is what they were talking about in that tempo sort of context earlier. Now, they go on further to say, however, given the current state of literature in regard to the effect of range of motion on hypertrophy, it is possible that the use of moderate external momentum at the beginning of each repetition could potentially have deleterious effects by decreasing time spent at long muscle lengths on some exercises. But they also say, alternatively, the use of external momentum may allow for more time spent training at long muscle lengths for other exercises, like a bent over barbell row, thus resulting in greater hypertrophy. And the findings in the simulation paper must be viewed in circumspection, of course, given that it is not directly assessed, they did not directly assess changes in muscle mass over time. So I do think that they make good points where, you know, as we get into things like the proximity to failure training, where we're training a little bit further from failure, there is a not only similar improvements in strength, but we can do more volume because we don't have as much fatigue or muscle discomfort. And so I think that that's probably what they're saying here, that if we use momentum, we can probably do a little bit more training because the training isn't as difficult. And they do mention the increased muscle length. Now, I don't have the notes right in front of me here, but in the paper, they also talk about which I thought was kind of funny. They talk about the muscular hypertrophy actions that would happen on some of the muscles performing the momentum. So let's say we're talking about the bicep curl still. I mean, there has to be some sort of muscular contraction to produce that kind of hip sway or that throw of the bar. And if we're concerned with hypertrophy, then those muscles are doing some sort of loading and some sort of contraction. And there's probably going to be some sort of hypertrophy there. So it's almost like a bicep curl goes from just being an isolation movement to being a full body movement. And there's probably a non-zero amount of hypertrophy happening at those muscles that are producing that momentum. So they get into practical recommendations here, and I'm just going to read these verbatim as well. We recommend that exercise, technique, and resistance training programs designed to maximize muscle hypertrophy should employ a range of motion that allows a muscle to be fully stretched while utilizing an eccentric and concentric phase duration that spans an overall repetition during duration of 2 to 8 seconds. Now, the repetition of 2 to 8 seconds seems to be sufficient to maximize hypertrophy, and it is unclear whether extending the concentric or eccentric phase of a repetition will lead to greater hypertrophy, which is what I had mentioned before. They said that they weren't really sure if it was like a longer concentric, a shorter concentric, and then a longer eccentric was the way forward. They just said that the rep in general should last between 2 and 8 seconds. Now, for range of motion, they say that you should employ a range of motion that allows for muscles to be fully stretched. And, you know, we can do a lengthened partial in a fully stretched position. And so that falls under that. And then the last practical recommendation for form is that that you should diminish involvement by minimizing the use of external momentum when possible. So they kind of say, you know, we're not really sure about the momentum thing. It could be good, it could be bad. We didn't really measure muscle mass changes, but for right now, maybe you should limit the external momentum when possible, which is totally fine. I think, you know, there's sort of theoretical ideas about what is going to work and not work. And if we're not sure yet, then we can really just make a soft recommendation for something like that. I'm not going to get into any sort of injury risk or pain or symptom talks here because, you know, I have to go do the CrossFit Open soon, but that can be for an entire different podcast. And I'm sure I've talked about that in the past. That is something I spend a lot of time talking about in our course, the Clinical Coach Challenge. So like I said, I believe that this is an open access paper. It's called Optimizing Resistance Training Technique to Maximize Muscle Hypertrophy, a Narrative Review. And so I think that you should definitely go read it. If you can't find it, just let me know and I will find it for you and I will figure out a way to get it to you. So yeah, if you haven't done the CrossFit Open, go do it. If you don't like CrossFit, then don't do it. But whatever you like doing or don't like doing, I hope you have a great weekend and I hope you continue to read literature. Bye.